Good morning, Your Honors.
Nice to see everybody here. I remember back in the day, a long time ago, but back in the day. Good to see everybody here. This case is here before us because of summary judgment that was granted by Judge Phillips of the Western District. We had two other judges prior to that. We had Judge Smith, who had to recuse himself. Then we had Judge Dean Whipple, who answered and did his order on the motion for summary judgment also. He said that there's too many disputed facts, the severity of the injury, the type of force used, the fact that he was charged for a municipal disorderly conduct at a rock concert, that there was definitely a chance for there to be excessive force, and because of the severity of the actions, that there could be malice because of the recklessness of the actions of the officers. Now, in Judge Phillips's orders, on a motion for summary judgment, the court knows the court must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which was us, plaintiff. Trial judge's function is not to consider the evidence and determine the truth of the matter, but rather determine whether there is a genuine issue for trial based upon the facts provided. The court acknowledged that there were genuine issues of material fact here. In her order, she acknowledges there's genuine issues of material fact and then proceeded to grant summary judgment to the defendants. This was clearly error. The first basis of the trial court's grant for summary judgment was that Mr. Carter was not entitled to qualified immunity with respect to count 3, which was excessive force for Gilbert Carter, the officer. September 2013, Buzz Beach Ball Concert. David Kasaya is there. He's crowd surfing, having a good time. A security guard sees what may be an altercation. Now, does not see any kind of fist being thrown, nothing like that. It's two men squared up, talking or yelling. They can't hear over the concert. They don't know what's being said. Gilbert Carter, an off-duty police officer, is motioned over, and they said, take a look. We want to see if these guys are fighting. Now, Gilbert Carter is 5'4", 220 pounds. The barricade's 5 feet tall. It has a step. The entire day, he didn't look over the barricade. He states that. Prior experience being at a concert as a police officer, zero. Any attempts to ever pull anybody over a barricade or lift him over his head, zero. Officer Carter gets up on the step. He looks into the crowd. He sees the two men. Cannot hear what's going on. A girl comes over and says, David Kasaya has been starting stuff with them, and he's bumped into her several times. Officer Carter waves David Kasaya over. In the police report, he says he reluctantly came over. Well, he came over. He complied. He gets to the fence. Nothing said. Reaches out to grab him. David Kasaya goes like this. Reaches again. Him and Officer White, another off-duty officer, pick him up over the 5-foot barricade, have him in the air 5 feet high. They say David then lunges or struggles in the air. Officer White loses control of his legs. Officer Carter then,
there are definitely different versions of what happened.
Oh, there's five of them, yeah.
At this point.
I'd like for you to focus on is the
legal implications of the fact that there are various stories that exist, not what the various stories are. We're not going to try to decide the facts.
Okay.
But what's the legal implication of the existence of these various accounts or stories of what happened?
It should be heard by a jury to give credibility and weight to the testimony of these individuals that were part of this interaction and this arrest. The judge decided, she decided that, well, it was more of the version of he slipped and they fell together to the ground. She chose that version and said there wasn't excessive force. Judge Phillips said there was not excessive force, even though the previous judge says there could have been. And we have two experts, not only just our own. Their expert says if you believe the facts as told by David Kasaya, you have excessive force.
Counsel, was there a discussion in the court's ruling or at the time of the hearing of the second prong of qualified immunity, clearly established prong? Was that ever discussed?
Well, as far as the qualified immunity, they won't have it if they violate David Kasai's constitutional right, which we've said is the Fourth Amendment. It's the excessive force.
But the right has to be clearly established. There can be a violation and it not prevent the granting of qualified immunity if the right was not clearly established at the time of the incident.
Okay. As far as the judge stated that as to the qualified immunity, obviously it protects government officials so long as their conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights which a reasonable person would have known. That's stated in her opinion. Then, further in the opinion, the judge states, sorry, Your Honor, the qualified immunity involves a following two-step inquiry, whether the facts shown by the plaintiff make out a violation of a constitutional statutory right, which David Kasai had the right to be secure in his person, whether the right was clearly established at the time of defendant's alleged misconduct. The judge then cites a claim of excessive force should be evaluated under the Fourth Amendment under Graham versus Connor, and the reasonableness of the amount of force is judged with the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene. Now, we understand, and we already said, as far as the lawfulness of making the arrest, as far as them having the ability to arrest him, that's fine. It's how they did it.
Well, my inquiry on the second point about the clearly established is the Supreme Court's admonished us that the determination of whether a right is clearly established can't be done at a high level of generality, that in essence there needs to be a case that's pretty close to the facts in the case before court that would have put reasonable law enforcement officers on notice that their conduct would be in violation of someone's rights. What's your case for a clearly established right in this fact scenario?
We would have Small versus McChrystal, which was cited in our response to the motion for summary judgment, Your Honor. And in Small versus McChrystal, we have an officer who's tackling someone from behind who appeared to have been intoxicated coming out of a bar. And so, again, we have a misdemeanor, and then we have the excessive nature of the force that was used.
Counsel, on the probable cause point to arrest, I think that's pretty important because, as I recall, that was an appeal, that determination was made. And then the question before us, and this kind of gets to Chief Judge Smith's question, is how do you effect the arrest? And whether the way you effect the arrest was done in an excessive way, using excessive force. And I guess my question is how was the officer supposed to do this? In other words, what was so obvious to a reasonable officer that he should have done it a particular way?
Right. This officer was working for a security company, so he's aware of security individuals along the barricade. They're actually helping crowd surfers down. These are big people, 6'5", 6'7", guys helping crowd surfers down. He also knows, as an off-duty officer, throughout the entire crowd of the concert and on the fence lines, there are other off-duty officers with radios. So if he's saying, I'm concerned with this barricade, we have a compliant person who walks up to him. He never says anything more about, could you hop over the barricade so I can talk to you? Could you go to that gate 20 feet over there so I can talk to you? Nor does he radio, if he's so worried about the barricade, he does not radio any of the officers, which he said was a possibility, does not radio any of the other officers within the crowd to say, we've got a situation, the barricade, I need you to approach the barricade. Nothing. He attempts to lean over and then another officer pick a man up, and then when they... Now he's on the ground with two vertebrae broken.
Well, I agree that it was pretty dumb. This was not the way you normally effect an arrest, is pulling a guy over a 4-foot-high barricade. But the question is whether it was excessive or not. He was effecting an arrest, and whether or not that's excessive.
It is excessive when you look at the force continuum. And that's what most policies and most police departments have. This goes to our other point as to why the policies are deficient. We have a 2-paragraph use of non-deadly force policy within the Kansas City Police Department. It says an officer may use any non-deadly force that he thinks is proper along with the equipment given to him that is non-deadly. That's it. It lays nothing out. There's no use of force continuum as to if the arrestee does X, officer should do Y. Most police departments have that. Specifically, we hear from the defense tactics officer, Officer Huth, who trains all the officers. He says the policy was changed after the Graham v. Connor decision because it simplified things and allowed us to better get our cases across and our witnesses across to a jury. I asked him, I said, is it better for the department? Do they understand their job more? No.
What should the policy have said, I guess is my question. It strikes me that it'd be pretty unbelievable if the policy said, well, if you happen to be off duty at a concert, please don't pull somebody over a 4-foot barrier.
They have no policy for off duty officers.
Right.
Well,
what should they have?
They have none. They have no training for off duty officers. They have no policy. Their policy should be just what it would be in a normal situation at a normal police department, not what they have over there. There's a garbage to begin with. But have one that has the use of force continuum, which says you start off here. If he doesn't escalate at the arrestee, you don't go to grabbing him and throwing him on his head and neck. Yes, Judge.
That's fine. I'll wait until the rebuttal.
Counsel, in your rebuttal, you can continue if you like, or you can reserve.
I'd like to go ahead and reserve the remaining time I have for the rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stone. Ms. Blake?
May it please the court, my name is Julie Marie Blake. I'm Deputy Solicitor General for the State of Missouri. I represent the Kansas City Police Board. What happened in this case was a tragic accident, but it was not an intentional use of excessive force. And I'd like to take the points as they were given in this case. First of all, he made a point that Judge Whipple had made an earlier interlocutory decision in this case, and he suggested that that was a reason for appeal should go back to that decision. As Judge Phillips said, that decision had not been made on the full record in this case, and this court, of course, should look at the full record as well.
Counsel,
what
about what appears to be some very disparate recitation of facts in terms of what transpired once the officer chose to grab the appellant? At one point, the officer said he was trying to help and someone lost their balance. Another point, after losing the balance, the officer says he threw the appellant. In another place, he doesn't say he threw him, but that they fell. The discrepancies of those facts, don't they create material relevant facts that probably need to be resolved before a complete conclusion of entitlement to qualified immunity can be determined?
Well, the district court properly applied this court's precedent when it took the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff to decide if there's material.
So did the court assume that the officer threw the appellant?
So
because that would seem to be pretty favorable to the plaintiff if the officer threw him over the barrier.
So what the court found was that it was a push, turn, or throw, and that it was undisputed that what happened was when Mr. Kazai was horizontal being lifted over the barrier, Officer White accidentally let go of his legs, throwing all the weight onto Officer Carter, who then stumbled, lost his balance, and then, quote, pushed, turned, or threw Mr. Kazai off of him. And what the district court said was that you needed to have evidence that it was intentionally trying to hurt him or intentionally use force in that situation, as opposed to merely stumbling and dropping him, and then he landed bad on his neck. And I mean, I think you're right that this is the linchpin of the case, is whether the word throw created enough of a fact issue to warrant going to the jury. And the district court got it right when it held that at summary judgment, Mr. Kazai had to show more evidence that that wasn't intentional conduct, that that was something that was meant to be more than accidental, as opposed to everyone agree that after he was over the barrier, they just dropped him and lost it. And as this court's precedents have made clear, the Fourth Amendment does not concern negligence or a lack of intentional conduct. So that, that's true.
But when you
issue.
Have a serial list of different opportunities to explain what happened and they differ, isn't that an appropriate purview of a jury as opposed to a judge on summary judgment to resolve what was intended by the officer?
Well, the way the judge resolved it was correct by setting aside the evidence most favorable to the defendants, not looking at, the question of whether Mr. Kazai was resisting or squirming over the barrier. The judge properly assumed that he was compliant and non-resisting, and that's the proper way to resolve these issues with qualified immunity and at summary judgment, is to assume that there was nothing that he was doing to cause fault in that situation.
I'll ask you the question I was going to ask Mr. Stump. I guess this doesn't seem to be an issue, but why are we even analyzing this under qualified immunity when the officer was off duty and was being employed by a private security firm at a private concert? I mean, is every time an off-duty officer is acting in a private capacity for a private for-profit entity, are they still cloaked with qualified immunity?
Well, in this case, you had a previous opinion of the district court that's not on review here that held it was an official capacity that the arrest was being made. And that's why we got here. And, of course, because the board won below, it didn't need to cross-appeal on this point. But would this court be inclined to remand? That might be an issue that would perhaps be explored again.
So do you... I guess that's what I'm trying to understand. Do you go back and forth between your role as a police officer? If you're acting as a bouncer at a nightclub
and
you happen to be off duty, do you all of a sudden go from being a private citizen to a police officer when you decide to arrest one of the drunk patrons?
I think the nature of the arrest was what motivated to think it was an official capacity here. But I agree that were this case be remanded, there might be quite a few other grounds in which the board could prevail in this case. That might be an issue later subject to review. And, of course, there are a number of other issues, as well as whether the right was clearly established, not to mention the police officer's version of the facts, which obviously do differ in material respects from the plaintiff's versions of the facts. If I can briefly address the questions this court had on qualified immunity, in his appellate brief, he has cited no case showing where it was clearly established to be a Fourth Amendment violation to lift a misdemeanor arrestee over a barrier to effectuate arrest in a crowded concert situation. He has mentioned the case of Small v. McChrystal, which is not in his appellate brief. The board did cite this in its brief on pages 28 and 30, but this case talks about an intentional tackle, intentional conduct, taking down an arrestee, and that is far too high a level of generality, and it needs to be a more specific case to show that this officer was on notice that this right would have been clearly established not to effect an arrest in this way.
On the clearly established point, suppose that we had a situation that you were discussing with Chief Judge Smith earlier where you're pulling him over the barrier and the officer just says, you know, I'm tired of this guy, throws him. I don't know that there's a case directly on point that says pulling somebody over a barrier and throwing them is excessive force, but one would think that would be clearly established that officers can't do that. What do we do in a situation like that?
Now, if I'm remembering correctly, is that the Hope v. Pelzer case, like the hitching post case, where the Supreme Court has said, hey, there's some violations that are so obvious that even if there's not a case on point, that just passes the test. You don't need to find a similar case. So if in your hypothetical, if there was a situation where he was just like, I've had it with this guy, smackdown, we'd probably be in a different situation.
And we're not there in this case, is your position.
Right, and the district court said that there was no evidence of intentional conduct beyond the phrase through.
Okay.
And which she did not believe resulted to the level of intentional conduct versus an accident, given the other undisputed facts of how the fall happened. If I could briefly address the point you also made, Judge Strauss, asking about the relevance of probable cause. Probable cause is relevant here because the disorderly conduct was a valid misdemeanor arrest that could happen. You know, the Supreme Court's instructed that in hindsight, if you could do arrests differently, that's not really the standard because officers have to make split-second decisions. And that is why his point about what the policy should say, that should be a continuum of force as opposed to leaving officers' discretion, is a mistaken point. As this court has made clear in cases like the Dick v. Montgomery County case, policies may leave discretion to officers to handle things in individual situations. And in that situation, the question then really merges with the merits of whether the actual violation took place in the situation. And as Graham and other cases make clear, what you can have is an individual officer who makes a reasonable decision. There might have been more reasonable decisions, better things made in hindsight, but not every push or shove or mistake rises to the level of an intentional use of excessive force. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blake. Mr. Sherman?
May it please the court. My name is Chris Sherman. I represent Gilbert Carter in this appeal. Because the issues at stake here overlap with the arguments of counsel have made, I'd like to begin just by addressing the question that Judge Smith originally asked, and I think some others have questioned as well, is what do we do with varying versions of fact? And to bring this discussion into view, I want to make sure we understand that this was done on a summary judgment motion through which facts were alleged to be uncontroverted and were, in fact, agreed to be uncontroverted. And it removes pretty much any doubt as to what happened here. If you direct your attention to the third page of the court's order, she lays out the facts that were alleged by the plaintiff, or alleged by the defense in summary judgment is true and were not controverted by the plaintiff.
So you don't dispute that the officer threw Kasaya over the barrier?
No. I do dispute it, and Kasaya has agreed that that didn't happen. So the facts that he admitted are this. As plaintiff was being lifted over the barrier, his body was basically horizontal or in contact with the barrier. That's paragraph 25 of the summary judgment motion. That's document number 92. While Carter was still holding on to plaintiff's upper body, White lost his grip on plaintiff's legs as plaintiff was being lifted over the barrier. That's paragraph 26. That was also uncontroverted. Carter then lost his balance as he and plaintiff began falling towards the ground. Paragraph 27, uncontroverted. Carter was standing on the step of the barrier and was still holding on to plaintiff as they began to fall. Paragraph 28, also uncontroverted. As he and plaintiff began falling, Carter pushed, turned, or threw plaintiff off of him, and they both landed on the ground. That's paragraph 29, also uncontroverted. Those are the facts of this case on summary judgment, and those are the facts upon which the court granted summary judgment. There is no dispute, other than for Kasaya to now say on appeal, well, his police report, he used the word throw. He didn't say pushed or turned, and he didn't talk about the falling. We can argue about whether he should have been more verbose and less concise in the police report, but for purposes of summary judgment, Mr. Kasaya had the choice to stand up and say, here are the facts that I have to prove that there was intent. He didn't do that. Instead, he said, I agree with those versions of facts. Those are the facts. And he's not in any position now to argue otherwise. The court also noted that the facts that Kasaya has that there is intent here are the conclusory allegations in his petition. There's nothing else to suggest. For example, that Carter knew Kasaya and they'd had a beef before over, you know, whose football team was better, or that they had had problems outside of this concert. They were strangers to each other. He gave no motive for Carter to pick him up and throw him down without having said a word. After the parties gave their depositions, the facts came out. White testified, Carter testified, and Kasaya testified. We set forth what we believed to be the uncontroverted facts. They agreed to them, and that's the record that they're stuck with today. Same thing is true. Kasaya likes to argue that there are disputes of fact as to, was it a woman who came up to Carter and said there was a fight going on? Was it a man? Was there a reluctance when Kasaya approached the barrier or not? Those things are removed from relevance because the court has determined there was probable cause for arrest and that was not appealed. So we simply need to ask the simple question, is it a constitutional violation for a police officer working at a concert to lift a misdemeanor suspect over a crowd control barrier with the assistance of another officer? And as has been pointed out, there certainly isn't a case saying that that's inappropriate. And so I would argue that that's not a clearly established constitutional right to not be lifted over a barrier. But given the concerns of, counsel has indicated, well, there was other options. You know, he could have radioed, he could have done this, he could have done that. We don't judge excessive force claims in that way. We judge them from what a reasonable officer would do, not with the hindsight of what we do when we have time to think about it in the courtroom. So given his concerns about compliance, ability to control the suspect, and officer safety going into the crowd, it was not unreasonable for him to lift him over the barrier. The resulting injury was, as acknowledged in the uncontroverted facts, simply an accident. I think the question was also asked about how qualified immunity is at issue here, given that Officer Carter was acting in a capacity as an off-duty officer working for CSI. That, just to be clear, that was a matter that was determined by the court, that he had stepped out of his role as a CSI employee when he made the decision to arrest Kasaya, and that is also a matter that wasn't appealed. Unless the court has any further questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Mr. Sherman, excuse me. Mr. Stump, your rebuttal.
As far as what Attorney Sherman had stated, that there was the uncontroverted facts, that's correct. We went through, and 23 through 29, at this time, Carter determined he would be arresting plaintiff. Yeah, we agree. Plaintiff denies squirming. Yes, we agree. While plaintiff was being lifted over the barrier, his body was basically horizontal and even or in contact with the barrier. Yes, we agree. While Carter was still holding onto plaintiff's upper body, White lost grip of plaintiff's legs. Yes, we agree. Carter then lost his balance, and he and plaintiff started to fall towards the ground. My guy at the time is hovering over the air. He can't see Officer Carter's feet. Officer White said he lost his balance. We agree. We have no problem if he lost his balance. He's losing his balance because he's on a step with a person bigger than him over his head. He has no business doing that. We don't have a case either directly on point for pulling someone over a barricade and picking them up over their head on a misdemeanor arrest and then dropping them on the ground, throwing them to the ground, or while they're going to the ground, turning in such a sense that my client lands first and he on top of them. That's the testimony of Officer White. Officer Carter said he didn't land on him. Officer White said he did. We don't have a case like that because, thankfully, other officers have not been so stupid as to attempt that.
But negligence...
Not when you have... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say negligence is not enough. I mean, the Supreme Court said that, we've said that, and I agree. I said it's dumb. I wouldn't... I mean, I'm not an officer, but that seems like a pretty dumb thing to do. But negligence is not enough.
They were never trained, any training, by CSI or the police department on how to act at the barricade. Now, they send them out to these security companies, their own private little police force, and expect them to know something. Here's the thing. They're never trained to do it. All of his acts that he did were intentional. He intentionally grabbed. He intentionally lifted. He had him over his head. And then he intentionally, at the very least, if you go the most to their side and not just getting thrown to the ground, he loses his balance and on his way to the ground turns and throws my client in the air like a hip toss. Those are all intentional acts for someone who was a misdemeanor on disorderly conduct because they thought these people were having an argument. Couldn't hear it. Never ask him about it. Never ask him one question prior to grabbing him and picking him up in the air and throwing him on his head. The non-deadly use of force guidelines are this for the Kansas City Police Department. Members will evaluate the situation to determine which available non-deadly force technique or issued equipment should be used to control the situation without compromising their safety or the safety of others. That's it. Members may use department-approved non-deadly force techniques and issued equipment to effect arrest, protect themselves, restrain and subdue, bring unlawful situations safely and effectively under control. It says the following.
Counsel, your time's expired.
Yes, that's their entire policy. He has nothing to go on. And so in doing so, he commits acts that are outside the scope of any kind of normal guidelines or reasonableness for an officer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stump. Thank you also, counsel for the appellees. Court appreciates your presence and the argument that you've provided to the court today and the briefing which you've submitted in the case. We'll take it under advisement. Madam Clerk, I believe we have one more case for the morning.
Yes, we do, Judge. Final case for oral argument is Michael Rogers et al. Versus Bill Bryant, etc.